Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Aaron Sager, a professor of law at Fordham Law School, where he has taught since 2003. He specializes in the areas of administrative law and regulation, legislation, education law, and property. Professor Sager has been a Spencer Foundation National Academy of Education postdoctoral fellow and a research fellow at Columbia Law School. He received his J.D. from Columbia and his Ph.D. from the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. He is also clerked for the Honorable Ruth Bader Ginsburg of the United States Supreme Court and the Honorable Douglas H. Ginsburg of the United States Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia Circuit. His writing has appeared most recently in The Urban Lawyer, The Journal of Law, Religion, and State, and the Cardozo Law Review. Aaron, welcome to Research on Religion.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Our topic for today is on an article that you penned for the Journal of Law, Religion, and State concerning the changing landscape of religious education and how that is going to affect our understanding of church-state issues in the future. But before we go down that path, I noticed that you clerked for Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Douglas H. Ginsburg. I got to ask, are those two folks related?
No, they're not related, and there was a period when they both sat on the same Court of Appeals, and they were still not related then, but they did get one another's mail, so they do have that bond between them.
Wow, that's got to be interesting, getting each other's mail, especially you got all that, you know, secretive court stuff. How does one get to be a Supreme Court clerk? That seems like a big deal.
The old law student joke about clerking for federal judges is that clerking for a judge is like winning a pie-eating contest when the prize is more pie, and that's more or less what it's like. These two clerkships were the greatest two pieces of professional good fortune I have had in my career, and you get them the same way you get any great job, mm-hmm. some combination of fortuity and, I don't know, something else, fortuity and...
Well, hard work.
And hard work.
The old saying is that opportunity is... preparation meeting opportunity or something like that.
That's certainly what it felt like. Yeah.
So
I had some people who went to bat for me, which I remain very grateful for, and they were really wonderful experiences.
Oh, very good. What does a law clerk do? Do you just go and get coffee, or what do you do?
The one sentence answer is you do whatever the judge tells you to do, but what I tell my students is that the law clerk is the judge's lawyer, so that any legal advice the judge wants, the clerk can provide. We don't do personal legal advice, but we do legal advice with respect to the judge's professional obligations. What that means in practice is that the judges decide all the cases. It's a very unusual arrangement in the federal government because in most of the federal bureaucracy, the staff stays the same and the leaders change. Right? The president comes and goes and the cabinet secretaries come and go, but the civil servants stay forever and they develop power that way, the civil servants do. And the judiciary works the opposite way. The judges stay forever, and the staff comes and goes. And the clerks are really the judge's staff, and we do research, and we make suggestions, and the clerks make no decisions. So they just provide input, and sometimes they provide drafting assistance. But their job is to make sure the judge does their job as well as the judge can do it.
Yeah, I can imagine the amount of cases that one would have to refer to as a Supreme Court justice or anybody on the Circuit Court of Appeals is just immense, and it's only growing year by year, and so it's very helpful to have folks who've recently come from law school who might know some of the more recent cases to draw from their experience, from their knowledge. I can imagine that's very helpful.
That certainly is, although federal judge I've ever known is on top of the evolving case law better than anyone else.
Really? That's fascinating, because just the amount of case law, and next week we are talking to a lawyer who does litigation and taxes for churches, the volume of stuff that comes out is just immense. I don't see how anybody could keep up with all that stuff.
Well, that's right. Although, of course, in every case, the first job falls to the lawyers of the parties before the court. You know, they send in their briefs and other papers, and it's really the law office's job to plow through the mass of law that exists and to identify which cases are relevant and how they ought to be used. So in some ways, a lot of the sorting and culling function really belongs to the attorneys for the parties and not to the judges themselves.
You have to ask, did you work on any monumental cases while you were up there on the Supreme Court, ones that might pop into people's head if they hear?
The term that I was on the Supreme Court was the term after Bush against Gore, so I was there not for the biggest case of the new century, but our term, we did the school vouchers case was before the Supreme Court, which we might have occasion to talk about this morning.
We will.
And the second in a series of cases restricting the use of the death penalty to competent adults was there that term. That was the case about persons who were developmentally disabled or otherwise mentally incompetent, and there was a ruling by the Supreme Court that those persons could not constitutionally be sentenced to death. That was a big case. There was a big environmental takings law case that term, and for those of us who are geeky about the law, there were a lot of other very important cases that no one would have heard of.
Yeah.
And to us, felt quite momentous. So.
Yeah. It must be somewhat gratifying and to look back and see that you have your fingerprints on parts of history, and that must be really neat. So.
It was a great job, and it is a good feeling, although, again, the judges make all the decisions, and clerks become very conscious of how dim their fingerprints are. These are very strong-willed people who know exactly what they want.
Okay, we go with the usual caveats. You're not responsible for any of the legal changes in the United States. So
it's the reverse. I'm responsible for all the mistakes.
Oh, there you go. Yes, you can pass them off.
I don't think there are any mistakes.
Okay, well, you mentioned the one court case that dealt with school vouchers, and that's our topic for today. And we want to dig into an article that you recently wrote called Religious Consumers and Institutional Change in American Public Schooling, Cases from Jewish Education. Our specific focus will be on how church and state issues have been affecting Jewish education, but I think our conversation is really more general than that, affecting all sorts of educational organizations and religious groups. Your article actually mentions Islam or Muslims. They mention the Amish and conservative Christians, so it covers the gamut. Your article points out that there's been a few fairly dramatic shifts in how K through 12, that's kindergarten through 12th grade schooling, has been delivered over the past few decades. I think we need to understand the nature of those changes, so it would be first important to discuss what education looked prior to, let's say, the 1990s or 1980s. Take us back, if you will, to the good old days. Let's say the 1970s, when I did my K through 12 schooling. What did the educational landscape look like then, and what was the role of private religious schooling?
So I was in school then, too. And I think still the way that school looked like in the ways that school looked in the 70s is still quite similar to the way that it looks today. And that system was that there were essentially two parallel systems of education in the United States. There was a public school system and there was a private school system. The private school system was one animal and the public school system was the other animal, and they existed sort of in parallel. They interacted very little, I think is the right way to phrase it. So the public school system is the system that all of us know. It's the system that's immediately evoked by any television show where there's a classroom and a teacher and a principal who doesn't know what she's doing and teachers who are committed and dedicated and tough and students who are, right? All of those stories that we've seen in the movies and on television, when as soon as you see that scene, you know that you're in a public school, and that's what they're like. They are run by the government, and everyone understood in the 70s and the 80s, and most people still think today, that when you go into a public school like that, you know all of these things. You know that the government pays. You know that there's no tuition. You know that everyone in town is allowed to go. You know that there's no religion in that school. Those are all things that we know about the public school system.
And also geographic location, too, that you get sent to the closest school to you.
You get sent to the school that's run by the community in which you live. There were in the 70s and are today, especially in the bigger cities, systems that don't send you to the public school closest to your house. Right? Some of that was occasioned by busing after the civil rights movement, and some of it is occasioned by other systems. So I live here in New York City. Our public school system involves all New York City children go to New York City public schools, but they don't necessarily go to the ones closest to their house. All New York City's children who want to go to public school go to schools in the city, but not necessarily to the one closest to their home. But in a standard American suburban community where there's one or two or three or five elementary schools, almost always kids go to the closest elementary school to their house. And in those places, there's often fewer high schools because high schools tend to be larger, and you often go to the high school in your town. That's the standard approach.
Yeah, no, I came from the countryside, so that is essentially what we did. The closest school to us is where you'd go, and you didn't get much choice in that.
That's right. That's the standard.
Yeah.
The standard American system.
Okay.
So if you don't like that system, then you can go to private school. That's been true in the United States forever. There's been private education in the United States for longer than there has been public education in the United States. And when public schools were institutionalized and brought into the government, the system of government, the opportunity to opt out in favor of private education has always been there. As far as I can remember, there has never been a successful effort to prevent people from enrolling their children in private schools per se. But the deal in the 70s and still largely until today is that that is a decision to opt out of a government service. It's like deciding not to let the government pick your garbage up or not to use the public park. It doesn't mean that you get any corresponding tax break. It doesn't mean that you don't have to get those services for yourself, right? If you don't want to take them from the government, then you have to procure them on your own. And what that meant was that private schools grew up as businesses. If you want to opt out of the public schools, you have to find some other way to educate your child because we have compulsory schooling in the United States, and you have to arrange for that to happen, and you have to do that out of your own pocket. Once you've done that, though, you can structure private schooling for your children with a reasonable degree of freedom. This is actually a little trickier, I think, than I understood as a school child in a private school, which was it is not true that the government doesn't regulate private schools. It does, just like it regulates all kinds of private businesses, and it regulates car manufacturers and restaurants and all sorts of other things to make sure that the public health and safety is served. The government regulates private schools to make sure that the educational goals of compulsory education are served. So you can't found a church school that doesn't teach mathematics, for example, in any state in the country. There are things you have to do. You have to take attendance. You have to teach math. You have to make sure that there's enough fire exits for the children to get out if there's a fire. All of these things are things that the government regulates and requires. But it's nothing like public school. The regulatory regime leaves private schools with a great degree of freedom, and one of those freedoms is to engage in whatever kind of religious activity it considers to be appropriate.
Now, when talking about public schools in the article, you'd mentioned that the, I guess, regulatory regime or ideological regime, however you might want to call it, was something known as progressive schooling. And what does that mean?
So I wouldn't say that's a universal term. Before 1890-ish, schooling was a very, very localized affair. If you think maybe some of our listeners read books like the Little House on the Prairie series as children, if you think about that kind of arrangement where the families in town got together and built a one-room schoolhouse, right, all the children had to be able to walk to that. There was no automobile traffic. Those were mixed grade, very small institutions. The town would hire a teacher. I have little girls, so we read them Anne of Green Gables. That's in Canada, so it's a little different, but it's the same system. The town fathers would get together and engage a schoolmaster or a schoolmistress to teach those children. The progressive movement, which is a big political movement in the United States around the turn of the century, was responsible for changing that system and developing the idea that public schools should be what they called common schools, that they should be open to all children, and that they should be common, by which they meant several things. One of them was that they meant that they should be commonly available, that every child should be able to go, that it shouldn't cost anything, that you should be able to go for free. And the other was that they would have a common culture, right, that all of these schools would be tasked with the job of making citizens, right, educating children to be citizens of the republic, and that they would do that by bringing in what was becoming an increasingly diverse population of children into the common culture of America. And that those two planks were big planks of the movement. progressivism was also quite, in that period, devoted to the idea of bureaucratic expertise in all sorts of areas, not just in education. But in education, that meant the idea that the right people to control a public school were not the town fathers, but were professionals, people who were trained to be educators, because progressives believed that experts were the right people to provide good government service. And so you got the rise of professional leadership in schools. And these sets of principles led, among other things, to the consolidation of all of these little, very local, hyper-local, one-room schoolhouse kinds of operations into school districts, which were much larger, professionally run and bureaucratically managed. By 1930-ish, maybe even a little earlier, that was the absolutely dominant model in the United States. Everyone by then understood the kind of system that I described as belonging to the 70s is the result of the total success of that change in the American educational landscape.
Now, how does religion fit into this progressive model? Because if you go back into the 1880s, 1870s, the town fathers are gathering, they're going to pick a teacher. It wouldn't be surprising to choose the local pastor or perhaps the person who leads Sunday school to do the teaching. Did we start to see a change during the first part of the 20th century away from religious education, or does that come later?
So this is a complicated historiographical question. The short answer, I think, is the following, short-ish answer. The idea of the common school was that there was a common educational, a common American culture in which American children should be educated to be good, functioning members of the society. At the time that these schools really took hold, there was a position about religion, which was that public schools, common schools, should not be sectarian institutions. But what they meant by sectarian is not what we mean by sectarian. What they meant by sectarian is that these institutions should not take sides with respect to intramural divisions among Protestants.
Mm-hmm.
So that if one looks at the vast array of denominational difference among Protestant sects, public schools ought to strive not to take any position with respect to those questions, and instead to make themselves generally available to all kinds of Protestants without regard to their particular religious commitments. So you see a lot of literature by the progressives insisting that there should be no sectarianism, no religious sectarianism in the common school. But that still allowed the ubiquitous practices in that period of doing things like opening the school day with the Lord's Prayer, reading the Bible at morning meeting. Those were things that virtually every public school did for a very long time, and that was the non-denominational Protestantism that characterized the American common school. The biggest fight over that was with the Catholic Church. When the Catholic population in the United States began to grow with immigration, there was very substantial conflict between Catholics and Protestants over whether this sort of non-sectarian Christianity really was non-sectarian Protestantism, or whether it could be non-denominational Christianity. And, of course, the clashes were instantiated over the two things that I've mentioned, which version of the Lord's Prayer to use and which Bible to read. And since Bible reading is a Protestant and not so much a Catholic practice, the Bible reading also became very important. And there was, right away, substantial efforts by Catholic educators either to create systems of Catholic schools that would allow opt-out by Catholics and or to push back on the non-denominational Protestantism of the public schools. Much smaller religious minorities at that time, Jews were not quite a vanishingly small minority, but close, and everyone else, a vanishingly small minority, had no public voice in that dispute that I'm aware of.
Now, I know the rise of Catholic education in response to this Protestantism, non-sectarian Protestantism in public schools is we pushed the Catholic Church into creating a fairly broad network of Catholic schooling, including Catholic universities that we see today. And it also gave rise to something known as Blaine Amendments, which we still see the echoes of today. So we'll be talking a little bit about that. You mentioned that over time, though, the progressive model moves to a situation of rigorous a religiosity? And when does this occur, and how does it take place?
So this is also a complicated historiographical and sociological question. I am a trained academic lawyer, so the thing I want to say but will resist saying without hedging a bit is that it was the Supreme Court. There was, starting around the several decades after progressivism was entrenched, the Supreme Court started to decide cases about religious freedom in the public schools. The great cases were in the 60s. The two cases that are most famous are the one that said that it was a violation of the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States that ensures the free exercise of religion and prohibits states from establishing religion, that praying in school was a violation of that requirement, that reading the Bible in school was a violation of that requirement. Those cases were in the early 60s.
Now, I should say those two cases were Engel versus Vitale, right?
That's right. Engel versus Vitale is 1962, and then right after that, I believe the next year was Abington, Abington Township against Shemp, which was the parallel case for Bible reading.
I have to mention, because we're in the middle of March Madness here, the Engel versus Vitale was not Dick Vitale, was it?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't know. To get him to shut up in school would be great, but I'm not a big fan of Dick Vitale, but there you have it.
I want to say something about that, which is the Supreme Court does not just create these kinds of decisions out of nothing. They stem from a very complicated political and social process in which the thinking of the country about these issues is changing. It's not the case, as some people have argued, that the Supreme Court is just a mirror which reflects a new political consensus. It certainly does not do that, but neither does it operate outside of a political consensus that is changing. And so when these cases come down, it's because there was pressure on the idea that non-denominational Protestantism was an adequate way of thinking about religious freedom in the United States in a country that was becoming more religiously diverse. And those cases are part of that movement, and the reaction to those cases were part of the response, so that it's not the case that everyone woke up one morning and was shocked to find that the Supreme Court had outlawed things that everyone in the country thought was innocuous. That wasn't the case at all. And in addition, after the Supreme Court decided these things, it didn't mean that there was sudden consensus in the United States that these things were problematic. There were then and remain still many people who think that these cases are deeply wrong and that it's fine, it ought to be fine and utterly consistent with our First Amendment values to pray in a public school or to read the Bible in a public school. I would say that position now is held only by a fairly small minority of people. These cases have been what I would call successful, right? The Supreme Court articulated a new norm which has more or less taken hold, but they are not isolated legal pronouncements which then somehow immediately transform the culture of schooling in the United States.
Yeah, this is the era that church-state issues are percolating up to the Supreme Court. We've had a number of other podcasts, and we'll link to those, about the Supreme Court and how it deals with church-state issues here in the United States. And it's after World War II, late 40s into the 1950s, and then into the 1960s, where a lot of these cases really start to get the attention of the Supreme Court. And you have a great quote in your article, and I want to read this because it really sets the stage for what is going to start happening in the 1990s and in the past decade. You say, "By the time the Supreme Court began to use a modern framework to analyze cases on religion and schooling, the wider American culture, including its schools and courts, had come to understand public schools as defined by these progressive principles." So, you know, here you're basically saying that the progressive model of common schooling, or as you also refer to it, one best system, is now starting to mesh with new First Amendment interpretations that are coming about in the late 40s and 1950s. Is that a good reading of that?
That's exactly right. I think that in some ways is the most important point I wanted to make in this piece. I'm sitting at my desk and I can see on my bookshelf a very famous book by a historian called David Tyatt called The One Best System. And it's essentially the history of the triumph of progressivism, right? That when the Supreme Court in the post-war period begins to address what it means to separate church and state, the institution that they see is the progressive public school, designed as a set of common schools based in school districts which were much bigger than a tiny, tiny neighborhood, but still quite local. The government runs those. The government hires the teachers. All the students go. There is no tuition. That's the public school system. Dissenters, religious, otherwise, can opt out at their own expense. But public schooling is those schools. That's all the Supreme Court could see. That was the ubiquitous monopoly understanding of the way that education worked at that moment. And all of those cases more or less assume that this has to be the structure of American education.
But society never stays still. It always changes. The economy is always changing. And this, there's a big change that we observe in the educational system. And you bring our attention to this in the rise of what we could best call quasi-public schools. And you're specifically referring to the charter school movement. And this becomes very, very important to your paper and also to the understanding of these religion and state issues as they apply to schooling. Tell us what charter schools are, how they came to be, and how they've grown over time.
So this is a very interesting phenomenon. The charter school is, it's difficult to say virtually anything about what it is without inviting controversy. The charter school idea began as a left-wing idea that said the following: schools ought to be liberated from total bureaucratic control by the government agencies that had come to run them, and instead should be, what happens in schools should be decided at the grassroots. The notion of these, I don't want to use the word progressive again because it confuses it with the progressive movement of the early part of the century, but these, and liberal isn't the right word either because it makes you think of political philosophy commitments that are different, so can I just use left? These sort of left-wing reformers thought, oh, you could get a group of teachers together, and they would put together a school that would be much better than the sort of hidebound, top-down, bureaucratic schools that Americans had come to see as not educating children as well as they could have. And that idea was out there. Then the idea was embraced on the right in the United States by people who also had a critique of bureaucratic, top-down, hierarchical schooling, and their critique was, markets are better than statism. It's better to let goods be produced in a marketplace which must respond to what people want than it is to have central planning and a system where the bureaucracy imagines what people ought to want and then gives them that and, moreover, does even that badly because they have no market incentives to function. And so they seized on this idea as a system where you could compete with the public sector and giving students what they want. What's evolved in the United States over the past 10 or 15 years is a system where a charter school is a school that is put together by private sector parties. Some group of people get together and they create a school. And then they apply to some government institution, this varies by state which one it is, for a school charter which allows them to run this school with public money. And there's some charter approval process, which again varies quite dramatically from state to state. And if a charter is approved, it can be approved for some period of time usually, then that school is entitled to seek students for its school. And when they agree to sign up, the state pays for it. The parents do not pay. What I do in the paper is I insist that these schools are clearly not public schools in the sense that we meant public schools in the progressive period or even in the 1970s, because they are not run by the government. They're run by private people. They are managed, they are private sector managed schools. But they are not private schools in the way that we understood them in the 70s either. Most notably, they are free. And they are supported by the state educational authorities and ultimately by the taxpayers and not by the parents who use them. And they're regulated. They're regulated more substantially than private schools and considerably less substantially than public schools. So they, in addition to the things that all schools have to do, they all have to teach math, they all have to have fire exits. But there are much more significant rules for charter schools. Usually those rules include they have to show a certain level of educational improvement to keep their charter. But they're still much less than traditional public schools, the states are much more hands-off about the tactics that they use to communicate content. They have control over things like the length of the school day, the length of the school year, which textbooks they use, how they organize their school days, whether they work on the weekends, if they're a school uniform. Are the teachers allowed to engage in collective bargaining? These are all questions that charters have a lot more flexibility with respect to than a traditional public school.
And a lot of these charter schools, too, have a certain flavor to them. Some have specialized in engineering and science. Others, you know, more social science and literature or arts or things like that, right?
So this was the idea, right, that if a group could get together and build a school that it thought would serve the needs of people, enough people to come and support it with their parents provide their children, and then the public money follows the children, right? So they market themselves. They think what would appeal to people. And one thing that has happened, not universally in the charter movement by any means, but it is a prominent part of the charter movement, is there's been some niche marketing going on where people say, what we really need is an arts school. There's not enough arts in the local public school system or in the private schools around here. We could make an arts school work. And they build a curriculum which still does math and still does all the things it has to do, but which has a focus on the arts. And these kinds of things are tested by the market. If parents want to send their kids there, then they do. And the school thrives. And if parents don't want to send their kids there, then the school can't bring in enough tuition money and it falls apart. But this kind of subject matter or curricular-focused marketing is common, although far from universal among charters. So there are plenty of charters that are arts-focused, that are mathematics-focused, that are engineering-focused, that are business-focused. And there are a bunch of unusual charter schools out there in the country. I know of one that focuses on horses. There's some maritime ones out there that focus on the sea. There are a few more industry-focused things out there, too.
And some of them will be religiously flavored, so to speak, and we'll get to that in a second. But I have to note how this movement has grown. Charter schools is something that I've heard in the background talk all the time, and I never really knew much about the growth of this. But you provide us some interesting facts about this, of how they grew since 1990 all the way till, you know, roughly today or so. What's been the growth rate?
In 1990, there were zero. The growth rate in that sense has been astronomical, because we have gone from none to, by 2000, it was 500,000 children. By 2000, it was 500,000 children, and so by 2010, it was up by another 1 million children. We were at around 1.5 million children, a little less, and there are, I don't know, a dozen big and medium-sized cities in the country which are well over 25% of their students are in charter schools.
Yeah, one of those you mentioned is New Orleans, and I'm wondering if the Hurricane Katrina disaster that basically leveled that city is one of the reasons why they're rebuilding it from charter schools from the ground up.
It is. New Orleans is a very interesting situation. The current mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, is the person who's credited with bringing into the Obama administration that old adage that you should never miss an opportunity that a crisis is an opportunity, right? And school reformers in New Orleans, who had long been unhappy with its system of public schools, viewed the hurricane as a chance to remodel the way that the public schools in that city worked. Our topic this morning is not the complicated politics of state local interaction with respect to school law, but some of those policy entrepreneurs were not people from New Orleans, but were people from other parts of Louisiana who were interested in having a new model for the city of New Orleans. But also there was just pure exigency, right, which is that big bureaucracies are slow to move. That's just a fact about life, is that it's very hard for a large bureaucratic institution that's educating thousands and thousands and thousands of children to cope with a disaster of the magnitude of the hurricane. And grassroots groups that can pick themselves up and make a school are somewhat more nimble. And so it was a situation which lent itself to real comparative advantage for that kind of private-public hybrid. And between those two things, the school system got rearranged so that there are traditional public schools now in New Orleans, but it's a mostly charter city.
Now, during this whole period of the 1980s and 1990s, another alternative system for thinking about education was also hot at the time, and that's the issue of school vouchers. How do charter schools relate to school vouchers? Is it an alternative? Was the voucher movement one of the catalysts to get people to think about charter schools? How does this all relate?
So I'd like to be very careful about this, so I'm going to try to be exquisitely careful. Many people would answer that question by saying that they are utterly different. Charter schools and voucher schools are utterly different. That a voucher school is a school voucher arrangement is an arrangement where the government subvents private school tuition. It uses those old categories of public and private schooling. A voucher system is one that says to parents, we will give you public money to attend private school. That was the voucher system that went all the way to the Supreme Court in 2002 and was found to be constitutional. That's the idea of the school voucher. For most people involved in the charter school industry, their self-image is that what they are doing is extraordinarily different from what a voucher school is doing, because their schools, they would tell you, are not private schools. Their schools are public schools. They are open to all children. They charge no tuition. They are part of the public school system. And this is the result, in no small part, of a conscious strategy on the part of charter school proponents to distinguish themselves from the idea of school vouchers, which was viewed both as a right-wing project, either economic right-wing or religious right-wing, and was viewed as a political loser around the time the charters started to rise. So charters have branded themselves as being distinct from voucher schools. They are public schools. They have this different arrangement than traditional public schools, but they remain public schools. My view is that this is not conceptually accurate, that charter schools are deeply similar to voucher schools in the sense that public money follows children to the schools that they choose, and those schools can be privately managed. That is true of both a voucher operation and a charter operation. In both operations, there are rules for schools that want to participate. With respect to vouchers, every voucher program has a set of rules that private schools must follow in order to receive a voucher, and every charter system has a rule that charter schools must follow in order to receive their charter. So I view these systems as quite similar, but the normative view out there is that the systems are quite different. It is true that the regulatory systems are different, though. The rules that a charter school has to follow are not the same rules that a voucher school has to follow. They vary by state, but there are obvious commonalities across the state, and one of them is that charter schools all face a state restriction that they may not engage in religious practice. Most private schools in most voucher programs that exist don't have that restriction.
And this is where it gets very interesting, and this is the heart of your article, because you mentioned before parents and private entrepreneurs have a great deal of control over shaping what a charter school might look like. And we talked about this niche marketing before. You have the maritime ones and the horse riding ones and different things like that. It does potentially open the door for, religiously flavored type of schools. And this is where the Jewish communities come in, and your emphasis on that, because what we notice just geographically is that certain people tend to clump around certain areas, that there's Jewish communities and there's Amish communities and Muslim communities. And to the extent that some of these localized communities can get together and create a charter school, it can create a very interesting flavor to this. So explain how this might work.
So the paper that we are talking about does use Jewish education as an example, but I really think of it just as a convenient example. The fact that the pattern of where people live involves people preferring often to live around neighbors with whom they share various commitments is ubiquitous across the country. And before the idea of a charter school or a voucher school ever crossed anyone's mind, right, if you went to school, say, in small town Mississippi in the 70s, you were going to a religiously inflected public school at that time, right? Because virtually all your neighbors had the same religious commitments, and this has a cultural effect. And so the idea that schools take on the aspects of the culture around them has always been true. And it's one of the things that the Supreme Court was fighting when it said, even though 95% of the people in your public school have the same religious commitments, nevertheless, you may not, in a public school, begin the day with the Lord's Prayer. That is to establish religion. For once the charter school idea comes along, though, it's a little more complicated to say that, because the reason that the Supreme Court can say you may not recite the Lord's Prayer, notwithstanding that everyone around you has this, almost everyone around you has the same religious commitments, is that you're doing it by using the state, right? State employees, state bureaucracies, state legislatures, state public decision makers are making the determination that the Lord's Prayer is the right way to start the day. Once you go to a charter system where you invite private groups to set the school up, that's not what it's like anymore. What you say to these private schools is, as long as you meet my regulatory requirements, everything from test scores to fire exits, how you go about your day is your business. And when you say that, then you invite a much wider set of practices out there. And the question really is, how religious can those practices get? So there are really two large questions about, sub-questions to that question. One is, could you let a charter school be genuinely religious, begin the day with the Lord's Prayer, have catechism class, engage in Bible study in the way that religious people think of Bible study, right, as a semi-devotional exercise and or as an exercise in finding out the truth? Is that allowed? And I think the dominant view out there is that it's not allowed. And the reason for that view is that charters have branded themselves as public schools, and we've all been trained to think public schools cannot be religious. But this is not my view. My view is that that's probably fine, because the basis for the Supreme Court's decisions that public schools cannot be religious rest on this idea of public management. And charter schools don't have public management. They just have regulation. And traditional private religious schools have public regulation too, so that can't distinguish them.
Now, there's one court case that keeps popping up in terms of this, and you discuss it quite extensively in your article. It's Zelman versus Simmons-Harris, and this is the school voucher argument or case, correct?
That is right.
So explain that and how that might relate to this first question here. Can a charter school be genuinely religious?
So the voucher system that went before the Supreme Court was in Cleveland, Ohio. It was fairly complicated, but to simplify slightly, the system provided poor children with a $2,500 check that could only be cashed by a participating school. And each parent was entitled to receive this check. They couldn't cash it for themselves, right? You can't turn it into groceries. But you have this check in your hand, and you can take your child and enroll that child not in the Cleveland public schools, which were in a fairly dismal state at the time. Actually, that's too kind. They were in an utterly dismal state at the time. And the state of Ohio decided to give these children these vouchers, which they could redeem for education at any participating school in the Cleveland area, which included explicitly private and religious schools. This was the arrangement. A bunch of rules attached to the schools that wanted to be able to cash these checks. They had to enroll in the program. They had to promise not to charge additional tuition above a certain amount. I believe it was $250. They had to promise to take all comers, and if they had more comers than they could fit, to choose among them by lottery. In particular, they had to promise not to engage in religious discrimination between people who applied. But they were not required to change their curricula. If they prayed before, they could pray afterwards. All of those things were considered to be fine. The idea was people would choose them only if that was fine with them. And the question was that came to the Supreme Court was, does this violate our basic principles of separation of church and state under the First Amendment if the state of Ohio is sending money from the public treasury via the parents to ultimately be used for the purposes of religious education? And the answer that the Supreme Court gave was no. This does not violate the system of separation of church and state, and the reason that it gave was that no decision to allocate money to religious institutions was being made by any government official. The only persons deciding to allocate public money to a religious school were private persons, the parents of the children. All the state had done was to give parents resources, right, to give them a check, and to tell them that they had to use this check for educational purposes of any kind, public or private, secular or religious. That was up to the parents. And the parents were invited to choose among these things. This is quite different from the traditional public school system, right? Which is also a way of giving parents a check. It's saying, you can send your kid here for free. Here we are. If you'd like to use us, you may use us. That's also a way of giving people resources. But the choice about what kind of school you get is not given to the parents in that system. The Supreme Court said giving parents this choice is fine, as long as the choice that parents make to use this money for religious purposes is what the court called genuine and independent, that the state is not pushing them into religious schooling. It's just inviting them on neutral terms to pick any school that they would.
So this would seem to fit pretty easily with charter schools because you're, you know, unlike vouchers where you give the bag of cash to the parents directly, you just give the bag of money to the school and then let the parents gravitate to whatever school they want. So it seemed like Zelman versus Simmons-Harris is a nice way of saying, yeah, you know, set up your own quote-unquote religious school and the bureaucrats aren't deciding that.
This is the banner that I am carrying. I have to say that I encounter resistance because of the insistence of the charter school industry that it is engaged in a system which is entirely part of the public schooling system. And so many of us have been taught and come to think of public schools as necessarily a religious, that this is a hard argument for them to swallow. But I absolutely believe that this argument is right. It sounds like I might have convinced you, which is thrilling to me. So,
It is very interesting, but here's the other case that works in the opposite direction here. And this case is directly relevant to me because it involves a university, or at the time it was a college, just down the street from me, and that is the Locke v. Davy case. Explain how that case might actually cut against the grain in terms of this.
So Locke v. Davy involved a program that sounds, in the way that I've described Zelman, sounds like it ought to be fine. It was a state scholarship program that gave graduate students money to pursue their graduate study. And the rules were, we'll give you this check, which can be redeemed at any graduate school that you choose. Pick your graduate school at will. But the state said, the exception is doctoral studies in divinity. You can't get your training as a clergyman using this program. Such graduate students are excluded. So it doesn't exactly cut against Zelman, right? The question in Zelman was, may a state choose to allocate this money neutrally in such a way that it can be directed by private parties to religious institutions? The question in Davy was, may a state create a system which allows private persons to direct their money to any institution except for religious institutions, right? Can the state choose to exclude religious institutions from an otherwise neutral situation in which the private persons decide? And the Supreme Court, again, in Davy, said, yes, the state need not exclude religious institutions from such a program, but it may choose to exclude religious institutions from such a program. That was the Davy case.
Yeah, so this creates a lot of head-scratching here, and I know that the Davy case here in the state of Washington also related to what we were talking about earlier, these Blaine Amendments, because the state of Washington becoming a state when it did was in the midst of this, you know, reaction to Catholicism, creation of Blaine Amendments, where Protestants were concerned about the Catholics wanting to get schools, and so they say, well, you can't use state money to create these schools in any way, shape, or form. And interestingly enough, the Blaine Amendment of Washington State was essentially upheld, if I'm reading that correct.
I think you're not.
Oh, okay.
Just in the sense that the Supreme Court stays out of questions of state law, right?
Right.
And so the Supreme Court is not interested in the operation of the Blaine Amendment, except to the extent that it's being asked whether the Blaine Amendment itself, the rule that the state constitutional rule in Washington and many other states, that public money cannot be given to sectarian institutions, whether that rule itself violates the federal constitution there has been some argument to that effect, that these are these state constitutional rules are unconstitutional under federal constitutional law, the argument being that they were motivated by anti-Catholic animus. They surely were motivated by anti-Catholic animus, but whether that motivation is enough to make the rules themselves unconstitutional is not has not been accepted by the Supreme Court.
Okay.
But given that, I do think that in the background of the Davy case was the unwillingness of the Supreme Court to force states to turn their backs on their Blaine Amendments, which is what an alternative holding in Davy would have done. But they really are consistent as a matter of federal law. The federal law in this matter, at a 30,000-foot level, is that if you're going to have a neutral program where the public treasury allocates to private persons some kind of financial resource, which they then can allocate across institutions for some purpose, that the state may allow such private persons to include religious institutions in the menu from which they select, as long as they ensure a genuine and independent choice, or they may choose to restrict the menu to secular institutions only. There actually is a legal argument that Davy should not apply to charter schools, but I think that that is probably not our topic for this morning, although I'm happy to talk about it if you want.
Well, what this does is lead to a lot of ambiguity about what charter schools can or cannot do, and I want to ask in terms of, you know, we're still dealing with your first question here, can a charter school be genuinely religious? And there's been from reading your article, it seems there's been a lot of tiptoeing around this issue, and you use a number of different examples from Jewish education to show how different Jewish communities have dealt with this. Give us some of those examples, because I think they're very interesting and creative.
Right. So the essential reaction to the Zalman-Davy set of constraints at this moment has been that every state that has a chartering system says in their charter law, we do not allow religious schools to charter. And that choice has more or less been deemed acceptable under Davy. So then the question is, how useful is the charter form to people who have interest in religious education, given that you can't get a charter for a religious school? And in the Jewish community in particular, that has been a very interesting question, because what Jewish religious schools do is not only religious. It also involves things that are associated with religious practice. And so one of the things that's happened in the community and is happening is that in the face of a state law that says you can't charter a religious school, Jewish educators and have looked at the market and thought there might be enough people out there who are interested in a Jewish school that meets that statutory requirement but still does many of the things that Jewish schools do. And they've essentially made a list of all the things that private Jewish education has always done in the United States, but that is not explicitly religious, and tried to build schools around these things, just as you might build a charter school around maritime studies or around the fine arts. And so there are now a bunch of these schools out there, and they do things like the following. Their foreign language is the Hebrew language. So any traditional religious Jewish school spends a lot of time teaching the children Hebrew, because functioning Jewish people who want to engage in religious practice need to know the language. But it's also a secular language, right? It's the official language of one nation on earth, and there's secular literature in it, and science is written in it, and so they teach the Hebrew language. They teach about the culture of Jews, right? So their social studies curriculum or their history curriculum has an emphasis in it that says this is the way that Jews celebrate holidays that are in the fall, and this is the way that they celebrate holidays that are in the spring. Anyone listening who goes to whose children go to a traditional public school knows things like that happen in traditional public schools all the time, right? When my kids were in school, they would come home and say, today we learned about the Aztec holidays, right? Because there's a curriculum in social studies that teaches children how various cultural groups celebrate various things or deal with various issues. And so these curricula do the same thing, but they inflect it with respect to Jewish practice. And some of them make themselves what's the right word, make themselves less difficult than they otherwise might be for religious Jewish students to enroll in. So, for example, their cafeterias observe the dietary laws, right? This is a practice which everybody eats, right?
Right.
So it's every school chooses its menu. They choose their menu in a particular way. They close early on Friday afternoon because students want to get home in time for the Sabbath. That's sunset on a Friday afternoon. Every school chooses its hours. They just choose their hours in a particular way, right? And so each of these decisions is designed to be not explicitly religious, but to be inflected or colored by this notion of the culture of the Jewish people. And there are parallel arrangements among Muslims, and there are even a few parallel arrangements among, more than a few parallel arrangements among Christians. I think the situation of Christians is a little different because they're the dominant culture in the country, and so it's a little harder to pull this off.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that because, you know, you give some great examples about this, you know, small Orthodox community in Lawrence, New York, and they're, I think there was a school system built around them just to accommodate them. So this whole charter school is fairly innocuous. People say, oh, yeah, you know, that's what they want to do. And, you know, since every kid in the school needs to get home for the Sabbath, you know, you close at, you know, noon on Friday and everything is fine. Keep the cafeteria kosher, et cetera, et cetera. But for evangelical Protestants, they, as you mentioned, they are the dominant culture. I shouldn't say evangelical, but I should say Protestantism in general, or Christianity in general, is the dominant culture. So it'd be more difficult to say, well, we want to create a Methodist charter school or a, you know, maybe even just more generic evangelical Christian school. And it's hard to do that because, you know, the language is English. It's not a, you know, so, you know, is that a problem?
It is a problem in several ways. The first thing I would say to what you said is I think among Christians with deep religious commitment, I would expect a fair amount of resistance to the claim our culture is the dominant culture in the United States.
They don't feel that way.
But it is true that there are fewer practices like the ones I've described that give Methodists a way to create a school which avoids the explicitly religious but still conveys the emphasis on a religious culture, right? The language of Methodists in the United States is English. And it's generally true that the commitments of believing Christians, especially on the evangelical side of the spectrum, has been much more negative, I would say, than positive in the following sense. They want to not teach things. The general projects of the evangelical conservative Christian movement has been to avoid teaching evolution, to avoid teaching that all family structures are the same, to avoid teaching cultural relativism. Those kinds of projects are different than the kind of project of, I want students to learn Arabic, to be fluent in Arabic, right? That's a different kind of, if you look at the curriculum of the local Islamically inflected charter school in my neighborhood, that's what it looks like. It's not about not teaching things, it's about how many hours can we give to Arabic study, and how many hours can we give to explaining what the cycle of the Islamic year looks like, and how many hours can we give to this and how many hours can we give to that. And that's much harder to pull off, I think, for Protestant schools. That said, they're doing it all over the country. A fair number of Christian academies that were private schools 20 years ago have now reconstituted themselves as charter schools. They've stripped out the overtly religious parts of their curriculum and left the rest and hoped that the rest was enough.
And that is a great transition to talk about this other issue about the funding of this. And I think that's your second big question. Is that correct?
It depends what you mean.
So the first one, can a charter school be genuinely religious? And there's ways, as we mentioned here, to tiptoe around that. But then the question becomes, if charter schools can become religious overtly, or, you know, quasi-religious, as we're talking about these Jewish schools that teach the Hebrew language and the history and things like that, it almost opens the door for a lot of private schools to, as you say, reconstitute themselves as charter schools, and that just really could shift the landscape from private schooling to charter schooling.
I do think that that is likely to be the most important effect of this kind of arrangement on the educational landscape in the U.S. is not to switch public schools to charters, but to switch private schools to charters.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right? And the fear of people who are interested in a strict separation, relatively strict separation between church and state, is that this whole project is one that essentially moves public money into the quasi-religious sector. Right? Again, you have to strip out much of the overtly religious content that you have in order to reconstitute your private religious academy as a charter school. But in return, you get the public money. And this is of great concern to people who think that public money should be kept far away from institutions with religious inflection. For others of us, the especially after Zelman, which says you can even send public money to overtly religious schools so long as the decision to send it is not made by a state official, this does not seem like a bad thing. In fact, it seems like a good thing. And I think there's a very substantial argument to be made that blurring this line in this kind of way, right, where overt religiosity is still not publicly funded, but in which people with genuine religious commitments can create school communities that help to actualize some of those commitments, is a way of repairing an unfortunate breach in American education, which has been that religious people have been sidelined by it, by the rule that the public schooling is utterly secular, has caused all sorts of people to drop out of the enterprise, both by withdrawing their children, but also by withdrawing their political interest, and by just sort of exiting the discussion of what public schools ought to look like.
You do a wonderful job in the article, too, talking about this in light of Jewish or Orthodox Jews in terms of the choices that they have to make in that older model of schooling where you have the one best system and then the parallel private school system. I mean, a lot of these Orthodox families have numerous kids. They want to send their kid to a religiously oriented school, but they're private schools and they're expensive. And if you've got four or five kids, you're like, whoa, can't really afford that. And the trade-off, you know, public schools, you don't get any of that. The charter school is, as we talked about, you know, constituting them as a Hebrew language or a Hebrew cultural type of niche within the charter school system, is that you don't get the full religious education, but on the other hand, it's a lot cheaper.
It's a lot cheaper, right? And as with any big industry which serves a population which has diverse preferences, for some people, a Hebrew language charter school that has stripped out institutions like Bible study and morning prayer is utterly useless to them. That's not what they want for their children. Their core commitments are overtly religious, and so a school that has stripped out religious commitments is just not suitable to them.
Mm-hmm.
They want to continue to exit that system, too, in favor of fully religious private education. That's a totally reasonable thing to want to do, and people do it all the time. And then there are other consumers for whom I mentioned in the paper that, you know, the Jewish community is fairly diverse in these respects. One population in the U.S. is secular Israelis who've moved to the United States for one reason or another. They have strong Jewish culture and no religious commitments to speak of. And they used to send their kids to private religious schools thinking of all the praying as a cost. That's what they put up with to get the Hebrew language immersion
mm-hmm.
for their kids, because they wanted their kids to speak the language of their families and of the culture that they grew up in. For them, these Hebrew language charter schools are ideal.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's all these people in between who would like the prayer but aren't really prepared to pay $100,000 in tuition to get it. And just like any, you know, marketing department in any enterprise, you think, what kind of people are out there? Who can I serve? Who will be utterly uninterested in me? Who is my marginal consumer towards whom I could move? And if I did that, what other marginal consumers might I lose? And that's the way that this system is proceeding.
Yeah, very interesting. I want to give you a chance before I finish up with some closing comments, because I may have interpreted your two questions. And we dealt with the first of the two major questions. You said, can a charter school be genuinely religious? What was your other question?
So what I just meant to say was there are really two questions in the that are facing the system. We've blurred them in this discussion.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is whether a state, I said all of the states have now required that charter schools not be religious. One question is, could a state reverse that requirement? Could some state in the union say, oh no, we're happy for charter schools to be religious. You need not strip out the overtly religious parts of your curriculum, and you can still apply for a charter, receive public money, as long as you continue to follow all of our neutral regulations about taking all comers, not discriminating in enrollment by religion. If you're willing to do those things and you pray in the morning, that's fine. States have chosen, no state has chosen to do that, but one important question is, could a state choose to change their chartering system in that way? My belief is they could. That would be question one. But I know there's plenty of people who disagree about that question one. Mm-hmm. And then question two is the question we spent some time on, which is, given the rule, given the state policy of excluding overtly religious institutions, how close to religious schooling can private persons putting together a charter school get? And that really is where these Hebrew language charter schools, these Arabic language charter schools, some of these we constitute Christian academies, do their work.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's just kind of a fascinating way that people adjust to all these different rules and regulations, and it's really neat to say. The paper is just absolutely fascinating. You close, though, with an interesting statement from Justice Stephen Breyer, and I think this was related to the Zelman case, if I'm correct, on schools. And he gave some kind of foreboding vision of the future of what would happen if we allowed these religious schools, and that it might possibly lead to more religious strife or conflict. And I'll just read his dissenting opinion here in the Zelman case. It is the Zelman case. Breyer writes separately. He says, to emphasize the risk that publicly funded voucher programs pose in terms of religiously based social conflict, I do so because I believe that the establishment cause concern for protecting the nation's social fabric from religious conflict poses an overriding obstacle to the implementation of this well-intentioned school voucher program. And by explaining the nature of the concern, I hope to demonstrate why, in my view, parental choice cannot significantly alleviate the constitutional problem. So as I read it, what he is saying is that if you allow school voucher programs, the specific issue in the Zelman case, but then generalize it more broadly to these charter schools, as we were talking about, it could lead to people cloistering themselves, people fighting over public funding for specific schools, and a lot more religious social conflict. What's your take on that?
So this is Breyer's position. The first thing to emphasize for our listeners is that Breyer is a dissenter in Zelman, right? He's on the losing side. And so this is a plea for the opposite result than the result that was accepted by the Supreme Court. But Breyer takes the position that the First Amendment to the Constitution that prohibits the establishment of religion by the state, another sentence in that opinion of Breyer's, is the First Amendment reflects the framers' vision of an American nation free of the religious strife that had long plagued the nations of Europe. Or, the First Amendment is designed in part to prevent the religious wars of Europe from entering the United States, right? And the notion was that by having non-sectarian common schools, non-sectarian in the sense that the court understands it now, not in the sense that it was understood in the 1920s, we avoid religious conflict. This is the values question about all of this, right? Which is, if charter schooling allows for a much greater inter-school diversity of approach, right, that public schools become not roughly the same as one another, not common, not an enterprise that brings everyone into a common culture, but niche, right, that works in a market, that looks at people's diverse preferences and tries to serve those preferences, so that my school might be different from your school, might be different from the third person's school, and no longer, to get difference, you have to pay this enormous penalty of still paying your taxes and in addition having to support your own niche interests. That what we get is a much more fractured population than we have now, a population where we aren't all educated, or most of us are not educated in the same way, where there's much less of an effective way to bring all of us and all of our children into a common culture. On the other hand, we are a diverse country, and one of the side effects of bringing everyone to a common culture is that it sometimes makes people feel as if they're own commitments are being trampled upon. And when I say feel as if, I don't mean to imply they're wrong. And this is really the values question that Breyer puts before us.
It is a tough situation that a lot of these, the freedom of choice comes with a lot of benefit things, and it also comes with a lot of cost in terms of that. How do you see all of this progressing? When do you see the charter school movement progressing, and to what extent might the issue of religious schools play out in the next decade or so?
I am aware that guessing about the future is perilous.
It is, but we always like to have our guests do that on the show at the end.
I think that this movement towards the idea that education will become less of a common school process and more one where the preferences of consumers are aggregated in something that looks much more like a marketplace than it does like direct government provision of services is an inexorable change in the United States. I think it's going to continue to progress. One of the big reasons, my current project actually, is I think the information technology is going to facilitate this, right? That as, especially for high school students, schooling moves increasingly online. And the idea that you have to be in a particular place at a particular time starts to disappear from schooling, as it certainly has for those of us who teach in universities. We know that a lot of the old ways of thinking about what it means to come to school in the morning are changing under our feet, that this is also going to accelerate this trend, right? Because it means that students can cobble together a school program from a math provider and an English provider and a something else provider, and if they can do that, not to allow the church provider to be in that system too is going to become even harder to maintain. So I think that that change is inexorable. I think that the regulatory response to that change need not be passive, right? It need not be that states and the federal government and all of us in our community say, oh, well then the efforts to create an educational system which somehow brings us all together with respect to some common commitments must be abandoned. I don't think we need to do that. I think that there are many ways to think about how to regulate this kind of provision, how to decide whether charters should be accepted or not, how to bring people into a notion where they can pursue both their private preferences and the common good at the same time, but which is a little bit less rigid about what commonality means, is going to be the great regulatory challenge in this area going forward in the next half a century.
Well, we will keep our eyes on that, and it's been a pleasure. My guest today has been Aaron Sager of Fordham University Law School.
It's been really fun. I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.